Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And Ken, I think we should begin on a serious note this week.
What's that? Not XM Radio?
The hearings featuring General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker before two different committees in the Senate, two different committees on the House side. And what did we learn?
Well, we learned what we intend to watch. We intend to watch to see how those three presidential candidates on the Senate side, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John McCain, would act, react, respond. Because obviously, two of the three will be presidential nominees in November, and obviously the war will be a big issue. But I did learn several things.
Could you run down the hearings and give us kind of a point by point for each of the committees and each of the two witnesses, and if you could include most of the senators?
I'd rather not. But what I did learn is that the end of the war is not anytime soon.
It's not in sight.
I predict it's not before January 20th, 2009.
Yes, that would be the inauguration day for the next president.
That's right.
So the new president will inherit not only a troop presence in Iraq, but it appears a troop presence somewhere in the vicinity of 140,000 troops, which would be more troops than we had in Iraq before the surge began.
And it seems very strange because the last time we saw Petraeus and Crocker at the hearing was back in September, and I think there was a big anticipation to see, you know, what progress was made. I think what we learned was progress was made, but it's fragile and reversible, which is like my the outfit I'm wearing today. And what I think is interesting also is that ultimately it doesn't really matter what happens in these hearings, because I think politics stands in the way.
You mean it was a political stage, having these two people in to be grilled?
Well, no,
because
they have
members.
To. I mean, they were required to. They were required to come in.
So it was not entirely just ginned up for the sake of the presidential candidates.
No,
it's a legislative requirement that they come in and report on the spending.
Exactly.
War.
But what struck me more is not so much what John McCain, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama said, but the remarks from other Republicans who realized that, oh my goodness, we're in this for the long haul, certainly throughout the 2008 presidential campaign. If this wasn't awful for us in 2006, wait till 2008 comes in. And for all these polls that say, well, this war is not going to be a major issue, it's about the economy, this war is there.
Yeah, even if the polls tell us that the economy is the main issue, or in some polls immigration rivals for the top issue for some voters, the war is still there, and the war has the potential, unlike other issues, to flare into an even greater importance without any warning at any time between now and the election.
The war will still be the issue, and if 70% or and above in this country thinks that the war was a mistake to begin with, and John McCain is saddled with having to defend it, or at least defend the surge, that could be bad news for John McCain.
Yes, it could, but let's also look at the other side of the coin, which is that since we do have American troops committed overseas fighting in danger, in harm's way, there is going to be a sense of standing behind the commander-in-chief. There's going to be a closing of ranks for many Americans. Not all Americans think that way, but a great number do, particularly of those who take part in presidential elections. And I would just like to point out that John McCain is going to have an extraordinary hold on those voters, not only through his own military background and service, but also because of his rather, I would say, impressive ability to marshal these arguments. Let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say at the hearing.
This means rejecting, as we did in 2007, the calls for a reckless and irresponsible withdrawal of our forces at the moment when they are succeeding. The promise of withdrawal of our forces, regardless of the consequences, would constitute a failure of political and moral leadership.
Now, of course, the Democrats would argue perhaps our troops are succeeding in providing a certain amount of greater security for the Iraqi people, but are they really securing the long-range goals that we have had that we said would enable us to withdraw?
And that's exactly what Hillary Clinton said several hours later in the same hearing.
Let's hear that.
It is irresponsible or demonstrates a lack of leadership to advocate withdrawing troops from Iraq in a responsible and carefully planned withdrawal. I fundamentally disagree. Rather, I think it could be fair to say that it might well be irresponsible to continue the policy that has not produced the results that have been promised time and time again.
It sounded like actually she was responding to John McCain, and in a way she was, even though it was several hours later. But in fairness to McCain, I thought he also asked some very important questions, too, because he was concerned about the penetration of the green zone.
You mean how are we suddenly finding people vulnerable inside the supposedly protected green zone?
Exactly. And also the fact that that last, the Maliki incursion in Basra, how 1,000 or so Iraqi troops defected. it doesn't sound like they're ready to take up the slack if we pull out.
This is the great contradiction in this policy, that when things go well, people will say, well, then fine, let's start pulling our troops out. When you start pulling a few of our troops out, and this is why they want to pause the withdrawals now, you see a sudden vulnerability or weakness in the Iraqi forces, which, of course, then gives an argument to the administration that we need to keep our troop levels high. So, in a sense, we're stuck one way or the other.
And I think Petraeus, I don't think Petraeus and Crocker were actually playing politics. I think they were assessing the situation as best they could. Of course, how we interpreted, how the Democrats and Republicans interpreted is where the politics come in.
Well, and also the president, who is speaking also this week, telling Congress that he really wants them to approve immediately the remaining $100 billion that's there in a special appropriation for the war in Iraq. He combined that with a speech in which he was also calling for shorter tours for the American troops, in the Army at least, the Army troops, down from 15 months to 12 months, which would make it somewhat more tolerable for those who are, especially those serving multiple tours. That should at least be a somewhat popular move. And in the same breath, practically, in the same week, the president also sending down some marching orders for Congress to pass a new trade pact with Colombia. So the president maybe at historic low levels of popularity. I think it's 32% on average in the polls, but he's been under 30% in some rather large polls, and yet he keeps sending down these imperatives and orders to Congress as though he were still in the 70s.
Well, I think he's younger than that, certainly.
Yes.
Yeah. But also, speaking of Colombia, there seems to be a debate on Colombia within the Clinton family itself.
Within the Clinton campaign.
Exactly. We saw the spectacle of Mark Penn, Hillary Clinton's chief strategist.
Who's always been a spectacle.
Exactly. Who's a longtime Clinton loyalist.
Back into the mid-1990s, he's been part of the team.
But not so much the Democratic Party, but more of the Clinton era.
The Clinton family.
And who, at the same time as the CEO of Burson and Marsteller, was talking to the Colombian government, saying that we're going to get this trade pact pushed through Congress, which, of course, once Hillary Clinton found out about that, it was embarrassing. Now, the question is
did she fire him?
Well, did she follow? Is he out?
It was played as a firing.
Right.
It was played as a Mark Penn sent out into the darkness.
To perhaps tell blue-collar workers in Pennsylvania that I'm really serious about this opposition to trade pacts.
As she did to blue-collar workers in Ohio and other states.
Right.
But then we also find out that Bill Clinton's been on the other side of this particular argument, not to mention other people who work for the Clinton operation. Where it could be a problem for the Clinton campaign is if it is seen in the context of other issues on which she has tried to have it both ways.
Well, that's like the Tuzla Tarmac.
Well, I dated Tuzla Tarmac, actually, in college. But
she's,
this was the story.
She's incredible.
This was a story where she told of being under sniper fire while she was visiting the Balkans, and it turned out that, in fact, they were handing her flowers. That hurt her more because she seemed to be so willing and eager to fictionalize her experience there in a way that I think reminded people of the worst moments of the Clinton administration in the 1990s. So if the Mark Penn incident is seen in that context, or if it fuels that kind of perception, it could be a more general problem.
But at the same time, even though I think a lot of us agree that Barack Obama seems to be mathematically on his way to the nomination, he still clearly has problems with white voters, with white ethnic voters, and he's obviously in Pennsylvania this week trying to win them over. He may not need to win Pennsylvania to win the nomination. He may not need these white ethnic voters if he's going to win the nomination, but he certainly needs them in November if he's going to have a chance against John McCain.
That's right.
And a lot of Democrats are nervous about that.
Well, he doesn't have to have every Democratic vote to get the Democratic nomination,
right,
but he has to have every Democratic vote in November because he's clearly not going to be able to win this thing on independent and Republican votes. And we've seen the Democrats fall back on their base in the past, and when they have done that, it hasn't been enough.
And Lanny Davis, a Clinton advisor, wrote an op-ed column in the paper this week who also talked about, look, there is residual unhappiness among Democrats about how Obama's handled the Jeremiah Wright situation, whether he should have quit the church, whether he should have spoke out earlier. And again, he says, and perhaps he's trying to do Clinton's work here, but he says, I think justifiably, that if there are a lot of white Democrats still unhappy with that answer, with his answers on that, it could stretch into the general election.
This is the Clinton camp's essential argument to the superdelegates at this point, which is that even if Obama is ahead among pledged delegates, you know, he's going to have problems in the fall. So you're going to have the courage to countermand the judgment of the majority of the pledged delegates and say, we don't think the pledged delegates knew at the time just how vulnerable a candidate he would be in the fall. That's their essential argument. And it still seems to be holding sway in places such as Pennsylvania, where all the polls still show Clinton ahead. Some show her well ahead. The Quinnipiac poll, which I think we've been watching most closely because it's the largest that's been concentrating on Pennsylvania, has it now at 6 points. It had been much, much
it was
larger.
Nine
three
before,
and four times larger.
It was 23 a while ago, right.
But the fact that he has trimmed off of her lead up to now, that's the easy part. The tough part is those last 5 or 6 points.
As we saw
and
in
then
Ohio.
Holding it, as right. we saw in Ohio, because you can get back to even and then fall back a little bit. A little bit like a basketball game. It's a seesaw, but the team that comes from way behind oftentimes falls a little bit short or is exhausted in the climb back from being far behind. We've seen something like that, I think, in other states that Clinton has won, and I think we're seeing it again in Pennsylvania. I think she's going to hold the last part of that lead.
But striking down the argument that she has to get out of the race because she can't win it, but if she wins Pennsylvania, and even though she may certainly lose North Carolina, she could win Indiana, and she could win Kentucky, and she could win West Virginia. I know I sound like
she's ahead.
I sound like Howard Dean here.
Yeah, you're about to scream. That's why I interrupted. Like, she's ahead in all those states.
Right. So, I mean, it's hard to make the case that she should get out because she's going to win 5 of the next 6 primaries.
But that's not the reason she would get out.
Right.
The reason people are encouraging her to get out is that even if she does win the preponderance of the remaining primaries, and it's not clear how many of them she will win, perhaps more than half, but Pennsylvania being the largest, Indiana being nearly the next largest, North Carolina going to Obama, he's still going to be ahead in pledged
right,
delegates.
Right, and looks like he's going to win North Carolina big.
And so he'll probably still be ahead in the popular vote as well. So we're still coming down to the problem Lanny Davis is trying to attack when he says, sure, he's going to be ahead in pledged delegates, but I'm warning you, if you nominate this guy, in the fall, the country is going to turn against him. While we're talking about November, how about that new juggernaut on the horizon? That new major power rising up out of the state of Georgia. It's
Bob Barr
is a serious candidate for President Ken. He is running as a Libertarian.
Now, let's just go back a little bit. First of all, we always thought all year long that it would be Ron Paul who was going to be the Libertarian nominee. He had been the nominee in 1988. He raised $33 million.
Didn't spend it running for the Republican nomination.
But he's still running for the Republican nomination.
Where's the money, Ron?
He's campaigning. I ask you that all the time. He's campaigning this week in Pennsylvania, even though John McCain wrapped up the nomination 3 years ago. But, so, Bob Barr, former Republican congressman, former Clinton tormentor when he was in Congress.
Yes, he was one of the leading advocates of impeachment.
Right, because of family values and the fact that he's been married 12 times doesn't matter. But also, he joined the Libertarian Party at the end of 2006.
How timely.
And lo and behold, this week he announced that there's an exploratory committee to run for the Libertarian presidential nomination. Given the fact that he's very strong on civil liberties, given the fact that he's a well-known conservative, he's a member
Second
of the
Amendment.
Second Amendment. He's on the NRA board.
Yes. Big gun guy.
Right.
Major gun guy. Big civil liberties guy.
Right.
All right. Bottom line question. More of a factor or less of a factor than Ralph Nader?
This year?
This year.
Ralph Nader is not a factor at all. And matter of fact, he really wasn't a factor except the fact that he got 97,000 votes in Florida in 2000. And that's why Democrats are still angry at him. But if there are still some conservatives, and I suggest there are, who have not bought into the John McCain candidacy, Barr could be the vehicle for this conservative dissatisfaction.
All right. Let's look back into the past for just one moment. I want you to walk with me, Ken, back several decades.
Yeah,
and remember one of the most bizarre incidents in congressional history, which was the death of Leo Ryan, among others, who had gone to visit the Guyana camp of Jim Jones, the Reverend Jim Jones, so-called cult leader, who brought a number of people from California and other states with him into the jungles in South America to pursue a bizarre personality cult.
There were charges that these people were held in the jungles against their will. So Leo Ryan, the congressman from San Mateo, California, in 1978, after the election in 78, went down with a few aides to the Guyana airstrip to investigate it. He went in and spoke to the people, and when he left, there was a very chilling threat from Jim Jones.
If by any chance you would make a mistake to try to come in and take any one of us, we will not let you. You will die. You will have to take anybody over all of our dead bodies.
And subsequently, the gunman cut down most of the people in Leo Ryan's party, including one of his aides, Jackie Speer.
Well, she's actually one of the few who survived. Leah Ryan was killed.
But she was wounded.
Right.
Yes,
seriously wounded. Leah Ryan was killed. Three journalists were killed. A former cult member was killed. Jackie Speier survived.
She came back to the United States. She established her own political career.
Actually, she ran for Congress in Leah Ryan's special district, finished third among the Democrats, didn't do well.
But then she ran for the state legislature.
Was there for a long time, ran for lieutenant governor in 2006, barely lost. And mm-hmm. lo and behold, 2008, just this week, she was elected to Congress to succeed Tom Lantos.
That's right.
Who later succeeded Leo Ryan.
Yes.
Lantos died in February. And Jackie Speier has gone from the tarmac of Jonestown to the halls of Congress.
Another question a lot of people are asking this week is, who is going to be John McCain's vice presidential nominee? This is perhaps the most valuable number two spot on a ticket we've seen in a long time because of John McCain's age and health questions. Also because it's just the best way to get to be the next president of the United States. So
look at Al Gore. He was vice president and then became president.
He won the popular vote. You were around for that, weren't you, in 2000?
Oh, wait, he didn't?
No,
wasn't
he
elected president?
Didn't get elected president. But many others who have been vice president have.
But he got the most votes, though, didn't he?
Yes, and that we'll explain that to you afterwards.
Yeah.
Just before you go to sleep.
Okay?
Just before you go to bed, we'll explain what happened in 2000.
Good night, Moon.
Who's going to be on that short list, Ken?
Well, a lot of dwarfs. Yeah. A lot of people from The Wizard of Oz.
Charlie Crist?
No.
Charlie Crist from Florida?
No. The news of the week is that apparently there's a Condi Rice boomlet, Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State.
Started by Dan Senior, the former spokesperson.
I didn't even know he was Spanish.
Defense.
Right, all right, Senior Dan. And, of course, the State Department denies it completely. They say that after the administration is over, she will go back to Stanford. But also, one of the big names that people keep talking about is Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota.
That's right.
Who's been a strong John McCain supporter.
Oh, he was the one who was a co-sponsor of that bill with the Virginia congressman.
Oh, Virgil Goode.
That's right.
That famous Goode and Pawlenty bill.
You know, that is a terrible joke, but our producer, Evie Stone, liked it so much she insisted that we have that in the podcast.
As it should be.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Once upon a time there was an engineer.
Choo-choo Charlie was his name, we hear.
He had an engine and he sure had fun. He's good and plenty candy to make his train run.
Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Charlie says, really rings the bell. Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Don't know any other thing.